I am, indeed, considered to be something of an expert on Terrans, Kalt said a little later, as they made conversation under the gnarled branches. Small insects buzzed near the Thenanin's breathing slits, only to be blown away every time they approached. That, plus my ecological expertise, won me my assignment to this planet.
Don't forget your sense of humor,
Uther Kalthing added with a smile. Yes. Kalt's crest puffed in the Thenanin equivalent of a nod. At home I was thought quite the devil, just the sort to deal with wolflings and timbrimmy pixies. He finished with a rapid, low set of raspy breaths. It was obviously a conscious affectation, for Thenanin did not have a laughter reflex as such.
No matter, Uther Kalthing thought. As Thenanin humor goes, it was pretty good. Have you had much first-hand experience with Earthlings?
Oh, yes, Kalt said. I have been to Earth. I have had the delight of walking her rainforests and seeing the strange, diverse life forms there. I have met neodolphins and whales. While my people believe humans themselves should never have been declared fully uplifted, they would profit much from a few more millennia of polishing under proper guidance. I can admit that their world is beautiful, and their clients promising. One reason the Thenanin were in this current war was in hopes of picking up all three Earthling species for their clan by forced adoption. For the Terrans' own good, of course. Though, to be fair, it was also clear that there were disagreements over this among the Thenanin themselves. Kalt's party, for instance, preferred a 10,000-year campaign of persuasion to try to win the Earthlings over to adoption voluntarily, with love. Obviously, Kalt's party did not dominate the present government. And, of course, I met a few Earthlings in the course of a term working for the Galactic Institute of Migration, during an expedition to negotiate with the Fafanfa. Uther Kalthing's corona erupted in a whirl of silvery tendrils, an open show of surprise. He knew his stunned expression was readable, even to Kalt, and did not care.
You have been to meet the hydrogen breathers?
He did not even know the trick of pronouncing the hyper-alien name, not part of any sanctioned galactic tongue. Kalt had surprised him once again.
The Fafanfa?
Again, Kalt's breathing slits pulsed in mimicry of laughter. This time it sounded much more realistic.
The negotiations were held in the Pool Kren subquadrant, not far from what the Earthlings call the Orion Sector.
That's very close to Terran's Canaan colonies.
Yes, that is one reason why they were invited to take part. Even though these infrequent meetings between the civilizations of oxygen breathers and hydrogen breathers are among the most critical and delicate in any era, it was thought appropriate to bring a few Terrans along, to show them some of the subtleties of high-level diplomacy. It must have been his state of confused surprise, but at that moment Uther Kalthing thought he actually caught a kenning from Kalt, a trace of something deep and troubling to the Thenanin.
He is not telling me all of it, Uther Kalthing realized. There were other reasons Earthlings were involved.
For billions of years, uneasy peace had been maintained between two parallel, completely separate cultures. It was almost as if the five galaxies were actually 10, for there were at least as many stable worlds with hydrogen atmospheres as planets like Garth and Earth and Timbrim. The two strands of life, each supporting vast numbers of species and life forms, had almost nothing in common. The Fafanfa wanted nothing of rock, and their worlds were too vast and cold and heavy for the Galactics ever to covet. Also, they seemed even to operate on different levels or rates of time. The hydrogen breathers preferred the slow routes through D-level hyperspace, and even normal space between the stars, the realm where relativity ruled, leaving the quicker lanes among the stars to the fast-living heirs of the fabled progenitors. Sometimes there were conflicts. Entire systems and clans died. There were no rules to such wars. Sometimes there was trade, metals for gases or machinery in exchange for strange things not found even in the records of the Great Library. There were periods when whole spiral arms would be abandoned by one civilization or the other. The Galactic Institute of Migration organized these huge movements for the oxygen breathers every 100 million years or so. The official reason was to allow great tracts of stars to go fallow for an era, to give their planets time to develop new pre-sentient life. Still, the other purpose was widely known, to put space between hydrogen and oxygen life, where it seemed impossible to ignore each other any longer. And now, Colt was telling him that there had been a recent negotiation right in the Poole-Kren sector, and humans had been there?
Why have I never heard of this before? He wondered.
He wanted to follow this thread, but had no opportunity. Colt was obviously unwilling to pursue it and returned to the earlier topic of conversation.
I still believe there is something anomalous about the Gubru transmissions, Utha Calling. From their broadcasts, it is clear that they are combing both Port Helena and the islands, seeking out the Earthlings' ecology and uplift experts. Utha Calling decided that his curiosity could wait. A hard decision for a Timbrimi.
Well, as I suggested earlier, perhaps the Gubru have decided to do their duty by Garth at last.
Colt gurgled in a tone Utha Calling knew denoted doubt.
Even if that were so, they would require ecologists. But why uplift specialists? I intuit that something curious is still going on.
Colt concluded.
The Gubru have been extremely agitated for several megaseconds.
Even without their small receiver or any news over the airwaves at all, Utha Calling would still have known that much. It was implicit in the intermittent blue light he had been following since weeks ago. The flickering glow meant that the Timbrimi diplomatic cache had to have been breached. The bait he had left inside the cairn, along with numerous other hints and clues, could only lead a sapient being to one conclusion. It was apparent his jest on the Gubru had proved very expensive for them. Still, all good things come to an end. By now, even the Gubru must have figured out that it was all just a Timbrimi trick. The avians weren't exactly stupid. They had to discover sooner or later that there really weren't any such things as Garthlings.
The sages say that it can be a mistake to push a joke too far. Am I making that error trying to pull the same jest on Colt?
Ah, but in this case, the procedure was so totally different. Fooling Colt was turning into a much slower, more difficult, more personal task.
Anyway, what else have I to do to pass the time? Do tell me more about your suspicions,
Utha Calling said aloud to his companion.
I am very, very interested.
Chapter 56 Galactics. Against all expectation, the new suzerain of cost and caution was actually scoring points. Its plumage had barely even begun to show the royal hues of candidacy, and it had started out far, far behind its peers in the competition. Nevertheless, when it danced, the other suzerains were forced to watch closely and pay heed to its well-parsed arguments.
"This effort was misguided, costly, unwise," it chirped and whirled in delicate rhythm. "We have spent treasure, time, and honor, seeking, chasing, hunting a chimera."
The new chief bureaucrat did have a few advantages. It had been trained by its predecessor, the impressive deceased suzerain of Cost and Caution. Also, to this conclave, it had brought an equally impressive, indicting array of facts. Data cubes lay scattered across the floor. The presentation by the head civil servant had, in fact, been quite devastating.
"There is no way, no possibility, no chance that this world could have hidden upon it a presentient survivor of the Burrarali. It was a hoax, a ruse, a fiendish wolfling and Timbrimi plot to get us to waste, squander, throw away our wealth."
To the suzerain of propriety, this was most humiliating. In fact, it was not much short of catastrophic. During the hiatus, while a new bureaucratic candidate was being chosen, the priest and the admiral had reigned supreme, with no one to hold them in check. They had well known that it was not wise to act so without the voice of a third peer to restrain them. But what being always acted wisely when opportunity beckoned seductively? The admiral had gone on personal search-and-destroy missions in pursuit of the mountain partisans, seeking gloss to add to its personal honor. For its part, the priest had ordered expensive new works built and had rushed the delivery of a new planetary branch library. It had been a lovely interregnum of two-way consensus. The suzerain of Beam and Talon approved every purchase, and the suzerain of propriety blessed every foray of the Talon soldiers. Expedition after expedition was sent into the mountains, as closely guarded scientists eagerly sought out a prize beyond price. Mistakes were made. The wolflings proved diabolical in their ambushes and animal elusiveness, and yet there would never have been any carping about cost had they actually found what they were looking for. It all would have been worth it, if only...
"But we were tricked, fooled, made fools of," the priest thought bitterly.
The treasure had been a lie, and now the new suzerain of Cost and Caution was rubbing it in for all it was worth. The bureaucrat danced a brilliant dance of chastisement of excess. Already it had dominated several points of consensus, for instance, that there would be no more useless chases into the mountains, not until a cheaper way was found to eliminate the resistance fighters. The plumage of the suzerain of Beam and Talon drooped miserably. The priest knew how much this must gall the admiral, but they were both held hypnotized by the righteous correctness of the dance of chastisement. Two could not outvote one when that one was so clearly in the right. Now the bureaucrat had launched into a new cadence, leading into a new dance. It proposed that the new construction projects be abandoned. They had nothing to do with defending the Gubru hold upon this world. They had been begun on the assumption that these Garthling creatures would be found. Now it was simply pointless to continue building a hyperspace shunt and a ceremonial mound. The dance was powerful, convincing, backed up with charts and statistics and tables of figures. The suzerain of propriety realized that something would have to be done, and done soon, or this upstart would end the day in the foremost position. It was unthinkable that such a sudden reverse of order should happen just as their bodies were starting to give them twinges preliminary to molt. Even leaving out the question of molt order, There was also the message from the Roostmasters to consider. The queens and princes back home were desperate in their queries. Had the three on Garth come up with a bold new policy yet? Calculations showed that it would be important to have something original and imaginative soon, or else the initiative would pass forever to some other clan. It was intimidating to have the fate of the race riding in one slipstream. And for all of its obvious finesse and fine preening, one thing was readily apparent about the new chief bureaucrat. The new suzerain of cost and caution lacked the depth, the clarity of vision of its dead predecessor. The suzerain of propriety knew that no grand policy was going to come out of picayune, short-sighted credit-pinching. Something had to be done, and done now. The priest took up a posture of presentiment, spreading its brightly feathered arms in display. Politely, perhaps even indulgently, the bureaucrat cut short its own dance and lowered its beak, yielding time. The suzerain of propriety started slowly, shuffling in small steps upon its perch. Purposely, the priest adopted a cadence used earlier by its adversary.
"Although there may be no Garthlings, there remains a chance, opportunity, opening, for us to use the ceremonial site we have planned, built, dedicated, at such cost. There is a plan, scheme, concept, which may still yet win glory, honor, propriety for our clan. At the center, focus, essence of this plan, we shall examine, inspect, investigate the clients of Wolflings."
Across the chamber, the suzerain of Beam and Talon looked up. A hopeful light appeared in the dejected admiral's eye, and the priest knew that it could win a temporary victory, or at least a delay. Much, much would depend in the days ahead upon finding out whether this bold new idea would work. Chapter 57. Athaclena.
"You see?" he called down to her. "It moved during the night."
Athaclena had to shade her eyes as she looked up at her human friend, perched on a tree branch more than 30 feet above the forest floor. He pulled on a leafy green cable that stretched down to him at a 45-degree angle from its even higher anchor.
"Are you certain that this is the same vine you snipped last night?" she called.
"It sure is. I climbed up and poured a liter of chromium-rich water, the very stuff this particular vine specializes in, into the crotch of that branch, way up there above me. Now you can see this vine has re-anchored itself to that exact spot."
Athaclena nodded. She felt a fringe of truth around his words.
"I see it, Robert, and now I believe it."
She had to smile. Sometimes Robert acted so much like a young Timbrimmy male, so quick, impulsive, puckish. It was a little disconcerting in a way. Aliens were supposed to behave in strange and inscrutable ways, not just like, well, boys.
"But Robert is not an alien," she reminded herself. "He's my consort."
And anyway, she had been living among Terrans for so long, she wondered if she had started to think like one.
If I ever get home, will I disconcert all around me, frightening and amazing them with metaphors, with bizarre wolfling attitudes? Does that prospect attract me?"
A lull had settled over the war. The Gubru had stopped sending vulnerable expeditions into the mountains. Their outposts were quiescent. Even the ceaseless droning of gas bots had been absent from the high valleys for more than a week, to the great relief of the Chim farmers and villagers. With some time on their hands, she and Robert had decided to have themselves just one day off, while they had a chance, to try to get to know each other better. After all, who knew when the fighting would resume? Would there ever be another opportunity? They both needed distraction anyway. There had still been no reply from Robert's mother, and the fate of Ambassador Utha Calding remained unclear, in spite of the glimpse she had been given of her father's design. All she could do was try to perform her part as well as possible, and hope he was still alive and able to do his.
"All right," she called up to Robert. "I accept it. The vines can be trained after a fashion. Now come down. Your perch looks precarious."
But Robert only smiled.
"I'll come down in my own way. You know me, Clenny. I can't resist an opportunity like this."
Ethelclena tensed. There it was again, that whimsy at the edges of his emotional aura. It wasn't unlike Sealf Kuan, the coronal kenning surrounding a young Timbrimi who was savoring an anticipated jest. Robert gave the vine a hearty tug. He inhaled, expanding his ribcage to a degree no Timbrimi could have equaled, then thumped his chest hollowly, rapidly, and gave out a long, ululating yodel. It echoed down the forest corridors. Ethelclena sighed.
"Oh, yes. He must pay respects to their wolfling deity, Tarzan."
With the vine clutched in both hands, Robert vaulted from the branch. He sailed, legs outstretched together, in a smooth arc down and across the forest meadow, barely clearing the low shrubs. He whooped aloud. Of course, it was just the sort of thing humans would have invented during those dark centuries between the advent of intelligence and their discovery of science. None of the library-raised galactic races, not even the Timbrimi, would ever have thought up such a mode of transportation. The pendulum swing carried Robert upward again, toward a thick mass of leaves and branchlets, halfway up the side of a forest giant. Robert's warbling cry cut off suddenly as he crashed through the foliage with a splintering sound and disappeared. The silence was punctuated only by a faint, steady rain of minor debris. Ethelclena hesitated, then called out,
"Robert?"
There was neither reply nor movement up there in that high thicket.
"Robert, are you all right? Answer me."
The Anglic words felt thick in her mouth. She tried to locate him with her corona, the little strands above her ears strained forward. He was in there all right, and in some degree of pain, she could tell. She ran across the meadow, leaping over low obstacles as the gear transformation set in, her nostrils automatically widening to accept more air as her heart rate tripled. By the time she reached the tree, her finger and toenails had already begun to harden. She kicked off her soft shoes and began climbing at once, quickly finding holds in the rough bark as she shimmied up the giant bole to the first branch. The ubiquitous vines clustered here, snaking at an angle toward the leafy morass that had swallowed Robert. She tested one of the ropey cables, then used it to shimmy up to the next level. Ethelclena knew she should pace herself. For all of her Timbrimi speed and adaptability, her musculature wasn't as strong as a human's, and coronal radiation didn't dissipate heat as well as Terran sweat glands. Still, she could not taper off from the full emergency speed. It felt dim and close within the leafy blind where Robert had crashed. Ethelclena blinked and sniffed as she entered the darkness. The odors reminded her that this was a wild world, and she was no wolfling to be at home in a Faerun jungle. Ethelclena had to retract her tendrils so they wouldn't get tangled in the thicket. That was why she was taken by surprise when something reached out from the shadows to grab her tightly. Hormones rushed. She gasped and coiled around to strike out at her assailant. Just in time, she recognized Robert's aura, his human male odor very near, and his strong arms holding her close. Ethelclena experienced a momentary wave of dizziness
as the gear reaction braked hard. It was in that stunned state, while still immobilized by change rigor, that her surprise was redoubled. For that was when Robert began touching her mouth with his. At first his actions seemed meaningless, insane. But then as her corona unwound, she started picking up feelings again. And all at once she remembered scenes from human video dramas, scenes involving mating and sexual play. The storm of emotions that swept over Athaclena was so powerfully contradictory that she remained frozen for a while longer. Also, part of it might have been the relaxed power in his arms. Only when Robert finally let go of her did Athaclena back away from him quickly, wedging herself against the bole of the giant tree, gasping.
An thwilleth bilen naha. You blinchuk. How dare you, Clithnum?
She ran out of breath and had to stop her polyglot cursing, panting slowly. It didn't seem to be penetrating Robert's mild expression of good cheer, anyway.
I didn't catch all that, Athaclena. My gal 7 is still pretty bad, though I've been working on it. Tell me, what's a blinchuk?
Athaclena made a gesture, a twist of the head that was the Timbrimi equivalent to an irritated shrug.
Never mind that. Tell me at once, are you badly hurt? And if not, why did you do what you just did? Third, tell me why I should not punish you for tricking and assaulting me like that.
Robert's eyes widened.
Oh, don't take it all so seriously, Clenny. I appreciate the way you came charging to my rescue. I was still a bit dazed, I guess, and got carried away being happy to see you.
Athaclena's nostrils flared. Her tendrils waved, preparing she knew not what caustic glyph. Robert clearly sensed this. He held up a hand.
All right, in order. I'm not badly hurt, only a bit scraped. Actually, it was fun.
He erased his smile on seeing her expression.
As for question number 2, I greeted you that way because it's a common human courtship ritual that I was strongly motivated to perform with you, even though I admit you might not have understood it.
Now Athaclena frowned, her tendrils curled in confusion.
And finally, Robert sighed, I can't think of a single reason why you shouldn't punish me for my presumption. It's your privilege, as it'd be the right of any human female to break my arm for handling her without permission. I don't doubt you could do it, too. All I can say in my defense is that a broken arm is sometimes an occupational hazard to a young human male. Half the time, a courtship can hardly get started unless a fellow pulls something impulsive. If he's read the signs right, the femme likes it and doesn't give him a black eye. If he's wrong, he pays.
Athaclena watched Robert's expression turn thoughtful.
You know, he went on, I'd never quite parsed it out that way before. It's true, though. Maybe humans are crazy cleft-nubs at that.
Athaclena blinked. The tension had begun to leak away, dripping from the tips of her corona as her body returned to normal. The change nodes under her skin pulsed, reabsorbing the gear flux.
Like little mice, she remembered,
but she shuddered a little less this time. In fact, she found herself smiling. Robert's strange confession had put matters, almost laughably, on a logical plane.
Amazing, she said. As usual, there are parallels in Timbrimi methodology. Our own males must take chances as well.
She paused then, frowning.
But stylistically, this technique of yours is so crude. The error rate must be tremendous, since you are without coronae to sense what the female is feeling. Beyond your crude empathy sense, you have only hints and coquetry and body cues to go on. I'm surprised you managed to reproduce at all, without killing each other off well beforehand.
Robert's face darkened slightly, and she knew he was blushing.
Oh, I exaggerated a bit, I suppose.
Athaclena couldn't help but smile once more, not only a subtlety of the mouth, but an actual full widening of the separation between her eyes.
That much, Robert, I had already guessed.
The human's features reddened even more. He looked down at his hands, and there was silence. Athaclena felt a stirring within her own deep self, and she kenned the simple sense glyph, Kinnewullen. The parable boy, caught doing what boys inevitably do. Sitting there, his open aura of abashed sincerity seemed to cover over his fix-eyed, big-nosed alienness, and make him more familiar to her than most of her peers had been back in school. At last, Athaclena slipped down from the dusty corner where she had wedged herself in self-defense.
All right, Robert,
she sighed.
I will let you explain to me why you were strongly motivated to attempt this classical human mating ritual with a member of another species, me. I suppose it is because we have signed an agreement to be consorts. Did you feel honor-bound to consummate it in order to satisfy human tradition?
Shrugged, looking away. No, I can't use that as an excuse. I know interspecies marriages are for business. It's just, well, I think it was just because you're pretty and bright and I'm lonely and maybe I'm just a bit in love with you. Her heart beat faster. This time it was not the gear chemicals responsible. Her tendrils lifted of their own accord, but no glyph emerged. Instead, she found they were reaching toward him along subtle, strong lines, like the fields of a dipole.
I think I understand, Robert. I want you to know that I...
It was hard to think of what to say. She wasn't sure herself just what she was thinking at that moment. Athaclena shook her head.
Robert,
she said softly.
Will you do me a favor?
Anything, Clenny, anything in the world. His eyes were wide open.
Good. Then, taking care not to get carried away, perhaps you might go on to explain and demonstrate what you were doing when you touched me just then. The various physical aspects involved, only this time, more slowly, please.
The next day, they strolled slowly on their way back to the caves. She and Robert dawdled, stopping to contemplate how the sunlight came down in little glades, or standing by small pools of colored liquid, wondering aloud which trace chemical was stockpiled here or there by the ubiquitous trade vines, and not really caring about the answer. Sometimes, they just held hands while they listened to the quiet sounds of Garth Planet's forest life. At intervals, they sat and experimented, gently, with the sensations brought on by touching. Athaclena was surprised to find that most of the needed nerve pathways were already in place. No deep auto-suggestion was required, just a subtle shifting of a few capillaries and pressure receptors in order to make the experiment feasible. Apparently, the Timbrimi might have once engaged in a courtship ritual such as kissing. At least they had the capability. When she resumed her old form, she just might keep some of these adaptations to her lips, throat, and ears. The breeze felt good on them as she and Robert walked. It was like a rather nice empathy glyph tingling at the tips of her corona. And kissing, that warm pressure, stirred intense, if primitive, feelings in her. Of course, none of it would have been possible if humans and Timbrimmy weren't already so very similar. Many charming, stupid theories had circulated among unsophisticated people of both races to explain the coincidence. For instance, proposing that they might once have had a common ancestor. The idea was ridiculous, of course. Still, she knew that her case was not the first. Close association over several centuries had led to quite a few cases of cross-species dalliance, some even openly avowed. Her discoveries must have been made many times before. She just hadn't been aware, having considered such tales rather seamy while growing up. Athaclena realized her friends back on Timbrim must have thought her pretty much of a prude. And here she was, behaving in a way that would have shocked most of them. She still wasn't sure she wanted anyone back home, assuming she ever made it there again, to think her consortium with Robert was anything but businesslike. Uther Calving would probably laugh.
"No matter," she told herself firmly. "I must live for today."
The experiment helped to pass the time. It did have its pleasant aspects, and Robert was an enthusiastic teacher. Of course, she was going to have to set limits. Willing to adjust the distribution of fatty tissues in her breasts, for instance, and it was fun to play with the sensations made possible by new nerve endings. But where it came to fundamentals, she would have to be adamant. She wasn't about to go changing any really basic mechanisms. Not for any human being. On the return trip, they stopped to inspect a few rebel outposts and talk with small bands of Chim fighters. Morale was high. The veterans of 3 months' hard battles asked when their leaders would find a way to lure more Gubru up into the mountains within reach. Athaclena and Robert laughed and promised to do what they could about the lack of target practice. Still, they found themselves hard-pressed for ideas. After all, how does one invite back a guest whose beak one has repeatedly bloodied? Perhaps it was time to try taking the war to the enemy instead. The problem was lack of good intelligence about matters down in the Sindh and Port Helena. A few survivors of the urban uprising had wandered in and reported that their organization was a shambles. Nobody had seen either Galet Jones or Fibbin Bolger since that ill-fated day. Contact with a few individuals in town was restored, but on a patchy piecemeal basis. They had considered sending in new spies. There seemed to be an opportunity offered by the Gubru public announcements offering lucrative employment to ecological and uplift experts. But by now the avians must certainly have tuned their interrogation apparatus and developed a fair Chim lie detector. In any event, Robert and Athaclena decided against taking the risk, for now at least. They were walking homeward up a narrow, seldom-visited valley when they encountered a slope with a southern exposure, covered with a low-lying expanse of peculiar vegetation. They stood quietly for a time, looking over the green field of flat, inverted boles. "I never did cook you a meal of baked plate ivy root," Robert commented at last, dryly. Athaclena sniffed, appreciating his irony. The place where the accident had occurred was far from here, and yet this bumpy hillside brought back vivid memories of that horrible afternoon when their adventures all began.
"Are the plants sick? Is there something wrong with them?"
She gestured at the field of plates, overlapping closely like the scales of some slumbering dragon. The upper layers did not look glassy smooth and fat like those she recalled. The topmost caps in this colony seemed much less thick and sturdy. Robert bent to examine the nearest.
"Summer's on its way out soon. All this heat is already drying the uppermost plates. By mid-autumn, when the east winds come blowing down the Moulin Range, The caps will be as thin and light as wafers. Did I ever tell you they were seed pod carriers? The wind will catch them, and they'll blow away into the sky like a cloud of butterflies.
Oh, yes. I remember you did mention it.
Athaclena nodded thoughtfully.
But did you not also say that...
She was interrupted by a sharp call.
General! Captain On Eagle!
A group of Chims hurried into view, puffing along the narrow forest trail. Two were members of their escort squad, but the third was Benjamin. He looked exhausted. Obviously, he had run all the way from the caves to meet them. Athaclena felt Robert grow tense with sudden worry. But with the advantage of her corona, she already knew that Ben was not bringing dire news. There was no emergency, no enemy attack. And yet, her Chim aide clearly was confused and distraught.
"What is it, Benjamin?" she asked.
He mopped his brow with a homespun handkerchief. Then he reached into another pocket and drew out a small black cube.
"Sayers, our courier, young Petrie, has finally returned."
Robert stepped forward. "Did he reach the refuge?" Benjamin nodded.
"He got there all right. And he's brought a message from the council. This is it here."
He held out the cube. "A message from Megan?" Robert sounded breathless as he looked down at the recording.
"Yes, sir. Petrie says she's well and sends her best."
But that's great," Robert whooped.
"We're in contact again. We aren't alone anymore."
"Yes, sir, that's true enough. In fact..."
Athaclena watched Benjamin struggle to find the right words.
"In fact, Petrie brought more than a message. There are 5 people waiting for you back at the caves."
Both Robert and Athaclena blinked.
5 humans?"
Benjamin nodded, but with a look that implied he wasn't exactly sure that term was the most applicable.
"Terrigan's Marines, sir."
"Oh," Robert said. Athaclena merely maintained her silence, kenning more closely than she was listening. Benjamin nodded.
"Professionals, sir. 5 humans. I swear it's incredible how it feels after all this time without... I mean, with only the 2 of you until now. It's made the Chims pretty hyper right at the moment. I think it might be best if you both came on back as quick as possible."
Robert and Athaclena spoke almost at once.
"Of course. Yes, let's go at once."
Almost imperceptibly, the closeness between Athaclena and Robert altered. They had been holding hands when Benjamin ran up. Now they did not renew that grasp. It seemed inappropriate as they marched along the narrow trail. A new unknown factor had slipped in between them. They did not have to look at each other to know what the other was thinking. For better or for worse, things had changed.